This is the second day of this October 2016 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called Zen Dawn. The subtitle is Early Zen Texts from the Dunhuang. That is the Dunhuang Caves. And these are translated by J.C. Cleary. We left off yesterday in the section attributed to Gunabhadra, who, according to this book, preceded Bodhidharma in the Chan lineage, or at least he precedes him here in the book. The second chapter here is Bodhidharma. The first is Gunabhadra. We left off where he made the point that the great path is fundamentally omnipresent, perfectly pure, and basically existent. It is not attained from causes. And then he compares it to the sun hidden behind floating clouds. The clouds, the idea being the clouds function as cause and effect, but the sun, sometimes I would say that the sky, is beyond coming and going, beyond change. Our true nature is beyond change and coming and going. Earlier yesterday, in Gunabhadra's talk, he talked about they referred to the six paramitas. We went through those yesterday. Here he picks them up again. Looking at each of the six paramitas, the six perfections, in a kind of transcendent way. So the first, the dana paramita, or giving, he says, having no attachments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment. This is called dana paramita, the perfection of giving. This first of the six is often regarded as the most important, the preeminent of the six paramitas, giving. And the way that it is rendered here by Gunabhadra as having no attachments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment, really puts it in it's really pointing to Zazen, no-minded absorption, no-minded awareness of things just as they are. This is giving up thoughts. This is the ultimate giving. And as most anyone would attest, it's the most difficult. We're so attached to our thoughts. We're so determined to continue to play with our thoughts, to turn them and round in the mind this way and that. Why are we so attached to our thoughts? I would suggest that it's because we're afraid of what would be beyond thought. Who or what we would be without thoughts. We're afraid of not being. Which is another way of saying, talking about the fear of death. And this is why In Sesshin, it is not so uncommon when people are getting very deep and the thoughts are thinning out in the mind, the mind is becoming empty, to suddenly feel anxious, be afraid of this void, this mind of clear emptiness. That's one of the Dharma gates that we have to pass through in order to awaken to our true nature, is to be willing to go into this void, this no mind. And to do that, we got to let go of the thoughts. And to let go of the thoughts, we have to lose ourselves completely in the practice at hand. We don't even have to think about letting go of thoughts. That's adding something extra to our job. It's simply becoming absolutely one with the particular practice we're working on. And in that uniting with the practice, the letting go happens. Not by us. We don't have to do it. That's where the relinquishment happens. So we're not rejecting our thoughts or even avoiding them. We're just becoming thoroughly one with the practice we're working on, the breath or the koan or whatever it is. And in that is the Dhanaparamita, the non-attachment in the ultimate sense. The second of the six perfections that he takes up is that of morality. The original Indian is Shila, S-I-L-A, which sometimes is translated as discipline. But here's how he talks about it. Good and evil equal, so neither can be found. This is Shila Paramita, the perfection of morality. Most people would hear this and at least certainly most people not in Zen, and they would say, what kind of life, what kind of religion is that you see good and evil as the same? There would be the concern about how we would conduct ourselves if we didn't frame our the world in terms of good and evil. Zen points to this source, the very source of these constructs of such as good and evil. Mind, a no mind. We don't need ideas of right and wrong or good and evil if we have just a sense of what the consequences would be of our actions, of our speech, of our thoughts. The next one he takes, the third perfection, is forbearance, or sometimes it's translated as patience, or kshanti is the original word. He says, to have no transgressions amid the objects of mind, the harm of rancor forever ended. This is kshanti paramita, the perfection of patience. There's a great analogy regarding forbearance or patience of the this comes from even before Bodhidharma. I think it's the Buddha himself who talks about, imagine yourself in a boat out on the water, on the river, let's say. Let's make it a rowboat, and you're from behind you, another boat collides with you. And what a natural reflex of many people would be to whirl around in anger. How could you be so stupid? Why don't you watch where you're going? And then to see that the boat is empty. What would that do to your anger? To see that the boat, that one, all emotions, all feelings, all things are fundamentally empty. Immediately neutralizes the reactivity, the reactions that we would have. The harm of rancor forever ended. This is Kshanti Paramita. The fourth is sometimes translated as effort or zeal. Energetic progress is how this translator renders it. And this is what Gunabhadra says: great stillness, unmoving, the myriad activities spontaneously so. This is Virya Paramita, the perfection of energetic progress or effort. So, no one making the effort, no agent behind the zeal or the effort, but just allowing this energy to function, to liberating this energy, which is what happens through Zen meditation. We all know this. Anyone who's been to Sesshin knows how the energy accumulates and builds as the days pass. The fifth is meditation, dhyana. And he says, the flourishing of wondrous stillness. This is dhyana paramita, the perfection of meditation. And then the sixth is wisdom, prajna. He says, wondrous stillness, opening forth illumination. This is prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. So he has it here as the effect, or the next step after meditation. Meditation he refers to as the flourishing of wondrous stillness, and then wisdom is wondrous stillness opening forth illumination. People, he says, who are like this are lofty and vast, taking in everything perfectly without obstruction, achieving rich and varied functioning. This is the great vehicle, the Mahayana. So we see how he elevates these six perfections or paramitas from just kind of a formula for doing good, being a do-gooder, into something entirely beyond just doing good. It really means functioning in harmony with our self nature. That's all. Or becoming who we already are. We always have been. He continues, because of their inverted perceptions, because of their karmic barriers, ordinary people do not see reality. This being so, light is not definitely light, and darkness is not definitely darkness. If you understand like this, and you are not confused by inverted thinking, then you will enter into the eternity, the bliss, the personality, and the purity of the Tathagatas. Tathagatas referring to the Buddhas, the enlightened ones. This series of four things, the eternity, the bliss, the personality, and the purity, is a translation of the four qualities of nirvana, sometimes it's said. We chant these in the Kanongyo, the 10-verse Kanongyo. Eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. Eternal, joyous, selfless. The translator his says the personality, and pure. This, he's saying, is what we can grow into through practice. This sentence, preceding sentence, this being so, light is not definitely light, and darkness is not definitely darkness. In the harmony of relative and absolute, we chant, within light there is darkness, but do not try to understand this darkness. Within darkness there is light, but do not try to find this light. In affirming faith in mind, these two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. And here Gunabhadra quotes the Lankavatara Sutra. How can one purify one's thoughts? I would think it's more accurate to pose the question, how can one purify one's mind? And then he says, do not allow false thinking, or do not dwell in your thoughts. Do not allow defiled thinking. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of Buddha. Now, let's be sure here. When he says mindfulness of Buddha, he's not talking about visualizing a Buddha figure or visualizing Shakyamuni or asking, what would Buddha do? But Buddha really means this Buddha mind, this no mind. And how do we access this no mind? Through the practice we're working on. So let's put it that way. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of the breath. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of mu. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of the koan, whatever it is. Or in the case of Shikantaza, put your utmost energy into mindfulness of just this. Let mindfulness of Buddha continue without a break. You will be still, without thoughts, and you will witness the fundamental empty purity. By the way, this is all still from the Lankavatara Sutra. And then Gunabhadra says, he also said, and now it's not clear who he is, whether it's the Buddha, who is considered the author of the Lankavatara Sutra, or Gunabhadra. It doesn't matter. They're both great. He also said, once this is received, you do not fall back from eternal stillness. Thus Buddha said, how can it be increased? How can it be increased? It's a rhetorical question. How can there be increase or decrease in this mind of eternal stillness? He also said, you learn from the teacher, but enlightenment does not come from the teacher. whoever would, quote, make people wise has never expounded the Dharma. A teacher doesn't need to make anyone wise. All wisdom, boundless wisdom, is within every single person. It's the teacher's job to help the student reveal it, uncover it, actualize it, live it. He also said, can you enter a jar? Can you enter a pillar? Can you enter fire? Can you go through a mountain? Do you enter bodily or do you enter mentally? He's in these statements, he's skirting along kind of a koans. There's some koans that are approach this wording. He also said, in a room there is a jar. Is the jar also outside the room or not? Is there water in the jar? Is the jar in the water? Are there jars in all the waters of in the world? What is this water? What is this water? What is anything? What is Mu? What is this? What is our essential nature? What is the nature of all things? In this essential, in the particularity of this essential nature, we may call it water, jar, room, Mu, self, other. These are all just words for this self nature, our own original mind. When he asks, can you enter a jar? You could see, can our true nature enter our true nature? We differentiate things with names. But each name is just this very nature of ours. He also said, the leaves of a tree can teach the Dharma. A jar can teach the Dharma. A pillar can teach the Dharma. A staff can teach the Dharma. A room can teach the Dharma. Earth, water, fire, and air can all teach the Dharma. Earth, wood, tile, and stone can also teach the Dharma. What is this? There's a saying in Zen, everything is Buddha. Everything is teaching. Do we have the ears to hear the teaching? Do we have the mind to hear it, see it? Through doing a lot of extended sitting, we can find our way into this mind of understanding, or even a jar, a blade of grass, an ant crawling across the floor is expressing this Dharma. The rain falling. It's a wonderful teaching of the Dharma. That brings us to the end of Gunabhadra, the chapter on Gunabhadra, and then comes the real rock star, Bodhidharma. And these old texts from the depths of the desert, in the Gobi Desert, as translated here, are purported to be about Bodhidharma. It says, it was meditation master Bodhidharma who took it up after Gunabhadra, Tripitaka. Intent on clarifying the great vehicle, he traveled by sea to Wu Wei, that's in brackets, coastal southeast China, and traveled north to Ye, the capital of the Wei dynasty. The monks Dao Yu and Wei Ke served him for 5 years, these are some of his successors, before he instructed him in the four practices. Listen to that. They served him for 5 years before he instructed them in the four. We'll get to the four practices just a little bit later. But no doubt he wanted to have them prove their sincerity, their dedication to practice over time. He wanted to see their perseverance before he felt that they could really receive this teaching of the four practices. I'll read on here more about Bodhidharma. Right after Sesshin, 3 days later, we're having Bodhidharma Day, in which we honor the founder of the Zen school. The Dharma teacher Bodhidharma was a man of southern India, the third son of a local monarch. His intellect was very incisive and clear, and he clearly understood what he was taught. His will was set on the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. He perpetuated the seed of the sages and made it flourish. With deepest mind, empty and still, he saw through and comprehended the things and events of the world. Inner and outer, he was clear about it all. His virtue went beyond the world. His compassion and concern reached every corner of the land. The correct teaching was in decline, so he came from afar across mountains and seas, traveling to teach in the lands of China. Those who cultivated mind-emptied still silence, I could see the translator struggling with that sentence, those who cultivated mind-emptied still silence all believed in him. The type who cling to forms and fixate on opinions began to slander and denounce him. Boy, that covers a lot of people. The type who cling to forms and fixate on opinions. What an age we live in that people seem, it's not only approved, but almost required to be spouting your opinions about people and things all the time. Liking and disliking. I guess this is a chapter about Bodhidharma, but not his words. During this time, he had only the two monks, Daoyu and Wei Ke, with him. Though they were younger, they brought with them wills that were lofty and far-reaching. Being fortunate enough to meet with the Dharma teacher, they served him many years, respectfully seeking instruction. They learned well, encountering the teacher's intent. Moved by their fine energy and sincerity, the Dharma teacher instructed them in the true path. He taught them how to pacify mind, how to develop practice, how to accord with beings, and how to employ skillful means. I love the sentence, moved by their fine energy and sincerity. Teachers are moved by the sincerity of their students, the way they apply themselves. There's no question about it. We think, or many people think of the teacher as affecting the student, encouraging, inspiring, and so forth. But it works both ways. It's a two-way street. Roshi Kapila used to say, no teacher is immune to a serious student. It continues, this is the great vehicle teaching for pacifying mind. Let there be no error. Those who pacify mind like this do wall gazing. Those who develop practice like this do the four practices. Those who accord with beings like this prevent slander and dislike. Those who have skill and means like this dispense with what does not apply. Here I abbreviate what is to be followed. The message is in the text below. And now this forthcoming text is attributed to Bodhidharma, his words. There are many roads for entering the path, but in essence they do not go beyond two kinds. One is entering through inner truth, and the other is entering through practice. Entering through inner truth means using the teachings to awaken to the source. There are several translations of this, the first of the two paths. What Cleary translates as entering through inner truth, I looked back and found in The Golden Age of Zen by John Woo, he says, entering by way of reason, which I think is problematic. But it seems to be just to kind of get the gist of it. It's awakening. Awakening to mind. But let's let him speak here. Entering through inner truth means using the teaching to awaken to the source. It means deep belief that living beings, both ordinary and sage, share one and the same reality nature. It is just because of the false covering of alien dust that it is not manifested. If you abandon the false and return to the real, concentrate your attention and gaze like a wall, then there is no self and others, and ordinary and sage are equal. Gaze like a wall. It's also interesting. Instead of just gazing at the wall, becoming the wall yourself. The wall against which the waves of thought crash and fall. Firmly abiding and unmoving, you no longer fall into the verbal teachings. This is tacit accord with the real inner truth. Without discrimination, it is still and nameless. This is called entering through inner truth. Another translation has this first of the two paths as entering through realization. And then he discusses the second path, entering through practice. And this, he says, refers to the four practices. All other practices are contained within these. What are the four practices? First, the practice of repaying wrongs. Second, the practice of going along with the causal nexus. Third, the practice of not seeking anything. And fourth, the practice of according with the Dharma. And he takes these one paragraph for each one. So the first of the four practices, what is the practice of repaying wrongs? Another translator refers to this as the practice of the requital of hatred. And here's what Bodhidharma says. When receiving suffering, a practitioner who cultivates the path should think to himself, so this is a practice of reflection, kind of mindfulness. When someone mistreats you, to reflect. During countless ages past, I have abandoned the root and pursued the branches, flowing into the various states of being and giving rise to much rancor and hatred. The transgression, the harm done, has been limitless. Though I do not transgress now, this suffering is a disaster left over from former lives. The results of evil deeds have ripened. This suffering is not something given by gods or humans. In other words, it's not just random, or it's not somehow dished out by someone else. It's dished out by us in the past. And then that's where he suggests, that's the reflection. And then Bodhidharma says, you should willingly endure the suffering without anger or complaint. The sutra says, I think he's probably referring to the Lankavatara Sutra, encountering suffering, one is not concerned. Why? Because one is conscious of the basic root. When this attitude towards suffering is born, you are in accord with inner truth, and even as you experience wrongs, you advance on the path. Thus it is called the practice of repaying wrongs. So it's a device, what Bodhidharma is offering us here. It's a way of settling down, of settling the mind when we feel we've been upended by some misfortune or some mistreatment, is to reflect on the fact that there are no accidents, that this is the effect of a previous cause that we ourselves have put into motion. And it is practical, it is effective. it takes the sting out of suffering. What is this root? He says, encountering suffering, you are not concerned because you're conscious of the basic root. The root is that which is beyond suffering, beyond any phenomenon, beyond samsara, beyond self and other. What is this root? Call it Mu, True Self, Original Mind. See why it can be differentiated from the first of the two paths. The first of the two paths is awakening, let's say, awakening to the source. And this is more of a thought process where you try to come to terms with misfortune through this exercise of a reflection on the nature of causation. There are no accidents. The second of the four practices is the practice of going along with the causal nexus. It's a very academic sounding word. Another translator says the practice of adaptation. But here what it says: sentient beings have no selves, but are transformed in a manner causally linked to their deeds. They receive both suffering and happiness. Both are born from causal conditions. If we get good rewards, glory and fame and the like, this is brought about by past causes. We receive them now, but when the causal nexus is ended, they will not be there. So how can we rejoice? Gain and loss follow the causal nexus. Mind is neither augmented nor diminished. If the wind of joy, that is joy at gain and sorrow at loss, if the wind of joy does not stir, you deeply accord with the way. Thus it is called the practice of going along with the causal nexus. Here's another translation. People can use this to triangulate the meaning here. This is John Wu from the Golden Age of Zen. The second one he calls the rule of adaptation. We should know that all sentient beings are produced by the interplay of karmic conditions, and as such, there can be no real self in them. The mingled yarns of pleasure and pain are all woven of the threads of conditioning causes. It's a beautiful translation. The mingled yarns of pleasure and pain are all woven of the threads of conditioning causes. If, therefore, I should be rewarded with fortune, honor, and other pleasant things, I must realize that they are the effects of my previous deeds destined to be reaped in this life. But as soon as their conditioning causes are exhausted, they will vanish. Then why should I be elated over them? So think of something dramatic, winning the lottery. If more lottery winners could apply this thinking, they might be able to keep their footing better. Therefore, let gains and losses run their natural courses according to the ever-changing conditions and circumstances of life. For mind itself does not increase with the gains, nor decrease with the losses. In this way, no winds of self-complacency will arise, and your mind will remain in harmony with the Tao. This, we get practice in applying this in Sesshin as like nowhere else, because until one has gone to many, 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 many Sesshins, one has to ride these waves of conditions going well, the condition of the mind being quiet and clear, and that alternating with the condition of the mind being flat, feeling stalled out, feeling frustrated. This is the great value of Sesshin and Zazen generally, is we're getting right in there, in this laboratory, and having to face these waves, these crests and troughs, and ride them out, and discover experientially, discover that they all pass. That in our absorption, in the practice we're working on, we have a way of weathering them and transcending them. As we said yesterday in Taisho, a lot of Sesshin is just not getting caught in states of mind, recognizing them as transient. It's holding fast to the practice we're working on. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind Bhattas. I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow attend all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend.